We have been working through the birth narratives of Jesus in the New Testament using this book, Awaiting the Already, as a devotional tool to prepare us in this Advent season leading up to Christmas. Each of the Gospels are unique in their description of the birth of Jesus for various reasons, including literary style, who or what may have served as their source material for each of the gospel writers, as well as the gospel writers' own reasons for writing the gospel. Who was it intended for? What was the context of the audience that they were writing to? And what were they hoping to accomplish? Each of the gospels are unique in their own ways, and the Gospel of Luke that we turn our attention to this morning is no different. Now, we actually don't know all that much about the man Luke. He's only mentioned in the Bible a handful of times throughout all of the New Testament where during the time that he lived. His name doesn't even appear in his own gospel. He's mentioned just a couple of times by the Apostle Paul in his writings, and he refers to him in one of his writings as a physician. So we know that Luke was a doctor, and we know that he was a traveling companion of Paul. Many believe that he accompanied Paul on some of his missionary journeys. Now, given the level of the implied education for someone in his line of work, this might explain why his Greek writing is considered to be some of the most sophisticated and eloquent Greek in all of the New Testament, second only to maybe the letter of that we know as Hebrews. It's also felt by many scholars that Luke was quite possibly a Gentile convert, Gentile meaning that he wasn't a Jewish individual. And this case is made because the Apostle Paul, in his letter that he wrote to the church at Colossae, mentions the names, specific names of Jewish individuals that were present with him at that time, and he makes the statement that these are the only Jewish individuals that are with him at that moment, but then just several verses later, he will then bring up that Luke is also with him, leading many scholars to believe that Luke was therefore not a Jewish individual, which would make him the only non-Jewish author of any of the New Testament writings. Luke is also considered to have written the book of Acts because of how the literary style is consistent with his gospel, but also because the recipient of both Luke and Acts is mentioned in the opening verses of both of those books, and it's this mysterious individual named Theophilus, whom we know virtually nothing about. When you consider both of these books, Luke and Acts, and you put them together, they comprise one-third of the entire New Testament. So Luke is responsible for a large portion of the New Testament writings. Now, it might be because of his education and his medical background, but it's very clear that Luke was careful and he was methodical in the composition of his gospel. And he states this in the very beginning of the first chapter where he says, "Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things that you have been taught." In this preface to his gospel, Luke indicates that he's putting all of this written account together for an individual named Theophilus. Apparently, Theophilus had already received Christian teaching in his life, but it appears that he needs or that he wants to have some additional assurances regarding the truth of those teachings. And so I'm kind of sure that he's representative of quite a number of early Christians who had received these teachings that had been passed down from the apostles, and yet for some of them, they needed continuing substantial assurance of the truth of those teachings. So Luke knows of no better way to provide this assurance than to tell the story as he knows it. to carefully give his account of the work of God from those who were firsthand witnesses to the event, to the events in, that he writes about, whom he likely had contact with, or from the passed down testimonies about the life of Jesus that Luke likely found were corroborated from multiple sources, which Luke would have had privy to in all of his travels, or from those accounts that had been written before Luke and were deemed to be authoritative. So Luke carefully investigated and brought all of this together to give an account of the work of God so that Theophilus and the other believers in the early church where this gospel was directed toward would be given some assurances about the accuracy of the life and teachings of Jesus and the purpose of the Christian community in this grand story of God's mission. I think we always have to be mindful of the fact that although we all have handwritten accounts of the Gospels in our Bibles, I mean, we even have them on our phones now, the Christians in all of the various churches that had begun to spread out beyond Israel in the mid to late first century may not have had in their possession any written manuscripts about the life and teachings of Jesus. All that they had received may have been in the form of oral teachings that had been handed down to them from the apostles and people before them. And so I could totally understand why Theophilus would want to have some kind of verification about the veracity of these teachings that were going on in the early church. So Luke is looking to provide this handwritten account, being as careful and thorough as he could in researching and organizing his narrative of the life of Jesus. And as I mentioned in the beginning, his gospel includes information than all the other gospels. In fact, it includes more information. Mark, as we learned in the first week of our series, he doesn't actually have much to say about Jesus' birth at all. And Matthew pretty much begins his gospel by jumping right into Jesus' birth after this long and lengthy genealogy about Jesus' ancestral tree. He does include a brief angelic visitation to Joseph before Jesus' birth, but it's almost like a side note. The unique thing about Luke's gospel is that he goes back to events that took place before Jesus' birth, and he does so in detail. Now, we don't have time to examine those stories in detail ourselves this morning, but Luke, in essence, begins to tell the backstory to the birth of not Jesus, but of John the Baptist. He tells the story of how John's parents, Zechariah and Elizabeth, also received word from an angel that they would conceive a child, despite the fact that they were childless for many years and were already quite old. If you read their story, it's pretty remarkable. And the ways in which all of it happened and the detail that Luke is able to provide about their life situation gives you the sense that he had spoken to somebody that had witnessed or had been told firsthand about these events. According to the angel, John would become the last great prophet of Israel who would begin to call the people back to God in order to prepare their hearts for the coming of the Lord. All of these events happened before Mary's stunning visitation by an angel to inform her of her role as the mother of the very Son of God. And then there is all of this anticipation and excitement as Mary and Elizabeth meet together while they are pregnant, and then eventually Elizabeth and then Mary give birth to their sons. There is this buildup that happens in the gospel as if Luke is saying that there is more to this story that happened before Mary gave birth to Jesus that you, Theophilus, need to be aware of. And you need to know that these things took place in order to appreciate the birth of Mary's son that much more. In any major sporting event that you watch, and I watch just about every single one, there's usually a buildup that happens before the event, right? I don't know about you, but I'm beginning to get tired of all of the pre-Super Bowl hype and all of the festivities that take place, right? Hours, days, and days before the actual game starts. Big boxing matches We'll give you the storyline behind each fighter and provide you with glimpses into their training camp that's leading up to the big fight. And then on the day of the fight, you'll actually have to watch some preliminary bouts, right? All just kind of priming you for the fight to come. Reality TV shows will look at the backstory of individual contestants' lives and some of the obstacles and hurdles that they had to overcome in order to get where they are. But all of this is really to prepare you or to promote or to point toward the actual event itself and to help you to appreciate the importance of that moment when it arrives. Luke has done this in the opening of his gospel. And really, if you think about it, this is what the entire Old Testament does as well. It's pointing forward to this coming event, to the coming of this Messiah, in order to emphasize the importance of that moment when it happens. And when important moments arrive in the Gospel of Luke, and there's more than one, there's something that happens if you look closely at the text. There's something noteworthy that occurs in response to these moments. And it's somewhat unique to Luke's gospel. If you think about your own life, you know, maybe the big or exciting moments of your life. It might even be imaginary moments. Or maybe moments that you witness in the lives of other people. But important moments that would result in you celebrating with abandon or without any inhibition or with all of your heart. What would some of those moments be? It might be news that someone that you thought was really ill and close to death had suddenly taken a turn for the better. It might be a time that maybe we've witnessed in our lives where in a country that had been torn apart by tyranny and oppression that the people found their freedom. I think of the coming down of the Berlin Wall and the people that were celebrating when I look back upon that time. It might be a moment in time when you really, really liked someone like that boy or girl and then you found out that they actually liked you back. Maybe for you it's a sports team that won a major championship. I think back to when the USA hockey team beat Russia, and I was in high school, and I remember running out of the house, and people were coming out of their houses and jumping around on the streets. I mean, what if the Kings won the NBA championship? It's imaginary, right? But what if? What if they were to win a championship? Do you think people would come out on the streets, run around? I think so. In biblical times, and really in most civilizations across history, celebrations of this nature and intensity were often accompanied by dancing and singing. And you actually see evidence of this, and it's unique to the Gospel of Luke's birth narrative. All of the primary characters involved in his prelude and the birth of Jesus break out into song upon hearing or witnessing or proclaiming the news of God's grace in their lives. Mary breaks out in a song. It's known as Mary's Magnificat. Zechariah sings an entire song. Elizabeth has a small refrain that she sings. The angels burst out in the sky above the shepherds with songs of praise. There's something about music and song that's tied to our emotions and that stirs us deeply in our souls. The writer of the devotional that we're going through, he discusses this idea. And he brings up a study that was done that talks about this interesting phenomenon. He says in his book, a recent study published in the journal Social Psychology and Personality Science revealed that certain songs can trigger activity in a person's hypothalamus, the part of the brain responsible for hunger, rage, and involuntary responses like blushing and goosebumps. But here's the interesting part. The researchers found that the style or genre of music did not determine these responses. What's more important is what they termed a person's openness to experience, one's willingness to be moved by the music, as well as other aesthetic and artistic experiences. So they have found that music can actually cause physical reactions in people. Have you ever had that? Physical reactions. Like maybe the hair, they say, on the back of your neck will stand up, or you might get goosebumps on your skin. Some people say that a shiver will go down their spines. Music and song has the ability to impact our emotions. It's able to help us to express our joy, and I think it is able to multiply it at the same time. It will calm us down, you know, when we're frightened or scared, like when a lullaby is sung to a child. It's often used to motivate and inspire us. I used to listen to Rocky every single time before I played a basketball game. I don't know if it made me play better, but it hyped me up. There seems to be this sense, though, from these studies that we have to be open to the experience. And based on that and what I see in Luke's gospel, it appears that Luke's gospel involves people who were particularly open to that kind of experience, open to the possibility of a surprising word of good news, open to a hopeful new beginning in the midst of even very difficult circumstances. And so my question to you is, how about you this season? Are you open to a new message or word from God in this upcoming holiday season that we're already in? Is your spirit ready and open to receive and experience what God might want to speak to you about at this particular time in your life? And maybe even right now, as we're spending our time together. For some of you, as we're about to spend some time in the upcoming moments in song and prayer, maybe God for you is going to make you aware of something in your life that's going to bring a certain warmth and joy to your heart, if you're open to it. For some of us, maybe this year, or it could be this time of year, is a difficult time for us. But then even then, I believe song has a way of helping us to express our sorrow and our anguish. Magre de Vega, in his book, talks about a 2008 novel called The Cellist of Sarajevo, which is this somewhat fictionalized retelling of the horrors of the Bosnian War that took place during the 1990s, but it's based upon an actual individual and what he did during that time. From the years 1992 to 1996, the city of Sarajevo underwent the longest siege of a capital city in the history of modern warfare. I mean, it was sieged for 4 years. People couldn't get in, people couldn't get out, supplies couldn't get in or out. And during this time, nearly 14,000 people were killed and over 100,000 homes and buildings were damaged and destroyed. One of the buildings that was destroyed was this bakery that was bombed by mortar shells in 1992 that killed 22 people who were just waiting in line to get some bread. In the immediate aftermath of this attack, rescue personnel and neighbors all rushed to the scene in order to help the victims, including Vidran Smailovic, who was just 35 years old at the time. And let me read to you what the book has to say about this event. Smailovic was not a doctor or a politician or a soldier. By many standards, he was essentially powerless to address the persistent rain of mortar shells and random sniper fire that deluged his beloved city on a daily basis. Smailovic was a musician, an accomplished cellist with the Sarajevo Philharmonic Orchestra. In the wake of the bombing at his nearby bakery, Smailovic did the one thing he knew how to do well. He took his cello to the very site where those 22 innocent victims were killed, and he began playing the hauntingly melancholy Adagio in G minor by Tommaso Albinoni. For 22 straight days, one for each of the victims, the cellist played the same song in various places around Sarajevo where violence and destruction had consumed the city. He often played right in the middle of rubble, or at funerals of the deceased, or even in open courtyards in the dead aim of sniper rifles as bombs and bullets continued to wreak havoc around him. His music brought comfort to the grieving and a therapeutic salve to a war-weary country. He provided a real-time soundtrack to the agonies of the suffering, expressing both latent and blatant pain in a way only music can. But more than that, his public performances embodied a bold confrontation to the powers at large, proclaiming that no act of violence and no evil deed could thwart the spirit of a people determined to live in freedom. In addition to joy, music has a way of expressing the pain that we feel in the struggles of our lives. And I think you will find evidence of this throughout Scripture as well, especially if you look through the Psalms of the Old Testament. Many of them are filled with the songs of people who are just waiting on God, people who are crying out, people who are singing out to Him for His saving help and His deliverance from their hardships. And perhaps this is why Luke's version of the Christmas story was written, in part, to provide us with songs that not only express joy, but that will also strengthen our souls in the midst of waiting and maybe even suffering. The song of Mary, if you read it, Mary's Magnificat, is filled with words of hope about the promises of God finally coming to fruition. But it's spoken and sung from out of a context of struggle and oppression. So, like we find in the story of Vidron Smailovic, sometimes songs provide us with a way to communicate and express our fears, or maybe our frustrations and longings that we have for maybe a better place than we're in right now.